We are now going to have a special class on that question. Where do menagim come from? So let's begin. We have to first define that there are a few different types of menagim. Okay? So not everything that we do is called a minag. There are certain things we do that are not a minag. You can't say that wearing an undershirt is a minag. Jews wear undershirts. Okay, so most Jews need glasses. It's the minag to wear glasses. No, that's not a minag. So not everything we do is a minag. That's obvious, right? That much we know. Yet there are certain things that are minag. There's a famous story of a girl who calls up her mother and says, "Ima, Ima, for years I've been doing this. I was wondering why. Every time I put a zucchini into the pot, I cut off both ends and I throw them into the pot and then the zucchini, because that's what you always did at home. Why do you do it, Ima?" So her mother says, "Well, my pot isn't big enough for a whole zucchini, so I cut off the two ends and then it fits into the pot." The daughter had a pot that was big enough, but she always saw her mother doing it. So not everything we see our mother doing is a minhag. But then there's the kid who says, "I will never cook one or two eggs alone. It'll always be three, because that's what my ima did." Right, there is a minhag never to cook less than three eggs together, and there's halachic reasoning behind it. After you cook the egg, you won't always find a blood spot. We assume most eggs don't have blood spots. Best of three, when you take one egg out, you're always taking three out of three. You can assume two out of three were good. So then that makes all three good. For example, okay, there are many things that we do that really are a minhag. So we shouldn't be quick to mock what people do. Okay, so now, what type of minhagim are there? But first, the story. You guys know the story of the Rama, Rabbi Moshe Isserlish? Rabbi Moshe Isserlish was in Krakow. And when he came to Krakow, there's a folk legend. I don't know if it has any sources. I once went searching for it and did not find the source for it. That the Rama came to town, and after davening, he saw the Gabbai go over to someone and tell him, "Mazel Tov." So the guy says, "Thank you." And then the Rama asked the Gabbai, "Why'd you wish a Mazel Tov? What just happened?" So he says, "Well, my wife is the mikveh lady, and whenever a woman goes to mikveh the night before, she tells me at night, and I go over to the guy in the morning, and I tell him, Mazel Tov, and he says, thank you, and then we both go out of shul like friends." So the Rama says, "That's so immodest. You're not supposed to know which ladies go to mikveh at night. There's a chayrim, the gaonim said, that you're a woman's not allowed to reveal she's going to mikveh. It's considered immodest. What are you doing? Why are you doing that?" He says, "No, that's the custom here in Krakow. That's what we do." So the Rama says, "Well, I'm the rabbi here, and I'm telling you, you stop doing that. Tell your wife, you guys, you shouldn't know which ladies go to mikveh at night. Because when a lady goes to mikveh, there's a mitzvah for her husband to be intimate with her. So it's not modest, you should know. Minhag's over. Stop it, okay?" So the rabbi says, "Rabbi, you sure?" He says, "Yeah." "No." "Okay." Story goes, a few days later, the Rama overhears the following conversation. The guy goes over to the Gabbai and says, "Gabbai, why didn't you wish me Mazel Tov this morning?" So the Gabbai says, "Well, the rabbi told me to stop the minhag. But my wife, you know, she's still doing the same thing she did. She doesn't, you know, she doesn't change so easily. So every night she still tells me which lady went to mikveh the night before. And I'm sorry to tell you, your wife didn't show up last night." So then the Rama understood the idea behind this minhag. In Krakow, it was freezing cold. And sometimes they had to chisel out ice for the woman to dunk. There was a very big Yetzer Hara for a woman to tell her husband, "I'm going to the mikveh," and then to go for a walk and show up 2 hours later. Because it took a lot of courage to go dunk in that freezing cold water. And so there must have been a time where some rabbi realized that women were cheating on their husbands. They were saying, "I'm going to the mikveh," not going to the mikveh. So he realized that it was so hard for the women, they needed to know that there was another check, that if they didn't go, that their husband would find out the next morning. So the rabbi, some rabbi at some point, instituted something very important in this community. That when the next morning, the gabbai, his wife, would tell the gabbai, and the gabbai would tell the husband. And that way, the wife always knew, and he saw. Here, he stopped the minhag, and 2 weeks later, A woman went home, her husband was intimate with her, and he just transgressed the Kares prohibition, where the Torah warns him that he and his children will die young, etc., because the Ramah stopped the minhag. So the story goes that the Ramah reinstituted the minhag, and this was like a landmark moment in the Ramah's lifetime to appreciate minhagim. That's the story that's told. Whether it ever happened or not is irrelevant. The message is important. We have to be very careful when we look at minhagim. So that's point number one. Minhagim sometimes are based that a rabbi of a certain town or a certain city recognized that there was a certain weakness or a certain need, and so the rabbi made that institution. So a minhag can be very localized. It could be that in this city, this minhag is necessary. So that's one type of minhag. I know a shul. Okay, we won't go into it. I can tell you a lot of minhagim in different shuls. And the minhagim, very often the rav really understands what the people need, and so he makes minhagim. I came to the shul that I have the good fortune to be a rav of, and people asked me to change a lot of things. The rav who was there before me made all kinds of institutions. And right away, people started clamoring, "You're the new Rav, we're so happy, could you change A, could you change B? Are we now going to be able to do C, are we now going to be able to do D?" And I said, rule number one, I'm not making any changes for 6 months. And I'll tell you guys a secret. It was clear to me that I won't make changes for a year. But I knew they couldn't handle hearing that. So I said, no changes for 6 months. And after 6 months, I said, I need another 6 months. Because I knew that it takes time to learn, to understand what people are, why people are doing things, where people are coming from. And ever since then, I try not to change anything he did. Because the smallest change I've made from his institutions, I've regretted. I don't know if there's any change I made that I didn't regret. And even though we're very different, and I disagree with him on many things, but I don't change. I don't change, and when I did change, I suddenly realized he knew what he was talking about, he knew what he was doing. As different as we are, and we're very different, I have a lot of respect for him, but we're very different in our halachic approach, in our hashkafic approach, we're very different. However, he knew what he was doing when he made his institutions for this community. And even as the community has grown, again, every change I've made, I've regretted. And I'll give you one example. I used to give class just before Matzei Shabbos. I still do halacha class. And people showed up for the halacha class, and it was the fullest shiur of the week. The whole Beis Medrash was packed. Why? Because people came for Ma'ariv, and so they knew there was a shiur beforehand. So people didn't show up on time. This guy showed up 2 minutes late, 5 minutes late, 10 minutes late, but people showed up because they wanted to catch the Ma'ariv. So they showed up 2 minutes early, 5 minutes early, 10 minutes early. They got part of the shiur or more of the shiur. And people kept telling me, it's a great shiur, make it longer. It's a great shiur, make it longer. Finally, I said, I can't start earlier. It was in the middle of the winter. I said, how could I start earlier? The Shabbos is so short, I can't start earlier. What I can do is postpone Ma'ariv by 5 minutes. We'll start Ma'ariv 5 minutes later. So I asked people, I took a census, 30 people told me it's a great idea. They all loved it. They said, yeah, we'll delay Ma'ariv by 5 minutes and you'll have the class for five more minutes. Fine. So we did due diligence. We did our homework. We announced that Shabbos. Next Shabbos, Ma'ariv is 5 minutes later. Okay? Same class, same Ma'ariv, everything. Ma'ariv is 5 minutes later. Everyone should know. Next Shabbos, almost no one showed up. The shul was empty. But everyone told me they wanted it. Right, but no one wanted to end Shabbos 5 minutes later. So the previous Rav, he had his class, and he had Ma'ariv et Seis, and right away we realized we made a mistake. Right away we switched back. We were never able to recoup those people. They never came back to that shul. Once they got used to going to another shul, in their minds, that's the shul that davens late Ma'ariv. Never. I was never able to fix that mistake. Okay? 5 minutes, and I asked the people. I didn't just do what I thought. I asked and I asked and I took 2 weeks asking. 5 minutes, we lost it. And it was the biggest minion of the week. And it never came back. Never. Okay, so that's a story. I changed one little thing from the previous Rav, and I thought it was like not a big deal, right? I one simple change, and it backfired tremendously. And what?
So did you do some work right away at stage? So did they
No, they went to another shul. They have other shuls they could go to, but now they didn't even learn those 10 minutes. I didn't gain by making the change. I thought they'd learn more. We ended up nothing. Okay, so that's a small story. Now, we have examples of this, and some of these examples affect all of the Jewish people. The Talmud says that when we established the calendar, so the rabbis sent a message to the Jews of Chutz Laretz, Hizaru b'minag avotechem bideichem. We're establishing this as a custom, what your forefathers did, that they would always celebrate 2 days Yom Tov. Now you're going to say, I don't need 2 days, I have a calendar, what do I have to keep 2 days for? The rabbi said, no, we are instituting it as a custom, retain that custom. There will be times that the empires will decree that Jews won't interact with one another, and Jews won't be able to know what we established here in Israel. You have to hold on to the 2 day Yom Tov in Chutz Laretz. So the rabbis instituted a custom. They took something which technically was completely permissible. Why do I have to keep a second day Yom Tov? I know which day Yom Tov's on. The rabbi said, we're instituting a custom. So here we have, we said there's a localized custom. There's a custom that's instituted by the local Rav, or by the city, or by this country. And then there are customs which are instituted for all of the Jewish people, where the rabbis said, be careful, retain that custom. It says that when Rav came out to Babylon, so he saw them saying Hallel on Rosh Chodesh. So Rav said to himself, what are they doing? Rav in Israel did not say Hallel on Rosh Chodesh. Then he saw them skipping, the way we skip in Hallel on Rosh Chodesh. So he said, why are they skipping? Whoever reads Hallel with skipping. When Rav saw them skipping, he said, ah, this is a minhag. They're not really saying Hallel. This isn't the Hallel like we say on Pesach, on Sukkot. This is a minhag. Ah, you see it's a minhag because they skip. So some minhagim, you see, Rav showed up and he wasn't aware of this custom. It ended up being the custom of all of Israel. Everyone says Hallel on Rosh Chodesh, right? No. Let's finish and then take questions. So we have minhagim that were instituted by the rabbis in the days of the Mishnah, in the days of the Talmud, and those minhagim are binding. The Gemara says, before you start davening, you should try to learn halacha. But don't learn halacha that'll keep you preoccupied, busy, and because there are all kinds of angles that are not so clear. Take a halacha that's obvious, that's clear, that everyone can you could learn and know and get it down pat, and then go into davening, so you won't have your mind busy with it. What's the Gemara's example? Rabbi Zeira taught the daughters of Israel, they accepted a stringency upon themselves that even if a girl sees a drop of blood, she waits 7 clean days over that drop of blood. That's a minhag. That's a stringency. Wait a second, that's not what it says in the Torah. The Torah says if she sees one drop, she waits 1 day. If it's within the time of her cycle, if it's outside the time of her cycle, we have all kinds of laws in the Torah. So our rabbinic institution began as a minhag. It began with the daughters of Israel accepting a custom upon themselves. And then that minhag evolved into a rabbinic institution, the way our laws of family purity look today. But when the Talmud says, before you start davening, learn halacha that's very clear, learn halacha that's obvious, it gives us an example of a minhag. So we see the Talmud is teaching us over and over and over again that a minhag is a very serious thing. A minhag is a part of being Jewish. If a person thinks that he can say, it's only a minhag, he's making a big mistake. A very core element of the Torah we keep is a minhag. Now, minhag breaks down into a few types of minhagim. We only described two so far. We said one of the city, and one that the rabbis instituted. but there are more. It says, let's take another type of minhag. So, there's a concept called dvarim amutarim. Some things are permissible. It's not prohibited. V'achirim nagu b'hem isur. And then some people decided to treat it as prohibited. So, what's an example? There were cities where two brothers wouldn't go into the mikveh together. That was their minhag. Two brothers are allowed to go to the mikveh together. They had, for whatever reason, they decided that brothers are, maybe they're close, maybe they knew in those towns the non-Jews were rampant into men running after men. I don't know what the reasoning was, but they said two brothers shouldn't go to the mikveh together. So it says Rebbe's two sons showed up to the mikveh. They showed up to the bathhouse. They wanted to take a shower. They walked in together. They started getting undressed. People looked at them and said, "What's wrong with you? Two brothers going into the shower, into the bathhouse together?" So it says they were both Tamidei Chachamim. They could have told them, "Excuse me, there's no such prohibition." They didn't do that. One of them stepped out and said, "Sorry." One of them stepped out and waited until the other one finished, and then the other one went into the bathhouse. Why? Because that's a second type of minhag. That's called dvarim amutarim. This thing is clearly permissible, but nagu b'hem isur. People accept it to treat it as prohibited. It's a custom. So, for example, the way Ashkenazim treat glass, we also agree that glass doesn't absorb, but our custom is that we don't use glass for meat and dairy together. That's an Ashkenazi custom. And we have many customs like that. So we have, when we speak about minhag, another element or another type of minhag is a minhag where we know it's permissible, but it was instituted to treat it as prohibited. So this can fall under the heading of the first one. It could be a rav of a town made this institution. It could be that the people saw it necessary to make this institution. Sometimes minhagim evolve, like the story of the daughters of Israel, where people realize, "I better do this, otherwise I'm gonna end up making big mistakes." So some minhagim are there to protect us from transgressing. And so we come to the second minhag, which is really, it goes hand in hand with the first one, and that is dvarim amutarim, something's permissible, v'acherim nagu v'hem isur. And then you have people who their custom is to treat it as prohibited. So that's custom number two, which can be an adjunct to custom number one. It could be an institution of a rav, it could be community, it could be grassroots, that the people saw it necessary. The Talmud tells us a story that one time witnesses came in late in the day to testify that it was Rosh Chodesh, and the Levites had messed up on the song of the Tumid sacrifice, and they had to burn the Tumid sacrifice, and the Levites got very upset. They said, you can't, we did everything right here, and then you end up burning the sacrifice, and then everything's messed up, you can't do that. So the rabbis accepted their complaint, and the rabbis made an institution, we don't accept witnesses past mincha time. Wait a second, but you're allowed to accept witnesses till sundown. Why? Rabbinic institution of a minhag. We're not accepting. Okay, now we come to minhag number three, which is also very, very important. Minhag number three involves permissible and prohibited. How does this work? Story time. War broke out. And every time the American army promised us they would show up, they didn't. And the Israeli forces had no choice. They kept advancing until they reached the Suez Canal. And they're in Egypt, deep in Egypt. And they ask their Rav, they say, "When we pray, should we do Birkat Kohanim? We're not in Israel anymore. This isn't Kansas anymore, Toto. So what do we do? Is this? Do we do Birkat Kohanim or not?" So the Rav said to them, "Well, we're in Egypt. The chief rabbi of Egypt is Rambam, Maimonides. So Maimonides holds you do Birkat Kohanim every day. We do Birkat Kohanim every day. What's going on? What's the idea?" The idea is, in a certain locale, they have customs of who they accept in halacha. Meaning, there's a third type of minhag, which is there's a custom of a people to go with this opinion in halacha. There are multiple opinions in halacha. Who do you go with? So we know Ashkenazim go with the Rama, Sfaradim go with the Shulchan Aruch, right? Taimonim go with the Rambam. It's not really like that. Moroccans accepted a lot of the Rama. In the Taimonim you have Daldaim, Shamim, Baladim, right? So you have a few different types of Yemenites, but let's generalize with all its inaccuracies. Let's generalize. We know that different communities accepted different poskim. So I was born a Yaki, I was born an Ashkenazi. But I love Sfaradi Psak. There's so many things I like about the Shulchan Aruch. I love the Sfaradi Nusach. I love so many things. I'd love to eat rice on Pesach. I'd love to wake up 30 days in a row early and say Slichos. There are a lot of things I'd like to do. I like the Sfaradi Slichos. You don't have to convince me. If I could go and daven with certain Sfaradim and Yonim on Yom Kippur, their whole tefillah takes 2 hours, like a Shabbos morning. You could learn the rest of the day. So yeah, I connect to the Ashkenazi tefillos. But okay, so I made a chulent of all my examples. But the truth is that we accepted us Ashkenazim. We accepted the rulings of the Rama. And so when we speak about what I'm allowed to do or not allowed to do with the fire on Shabbos, the Rama went the line of the Ashkenazi poskin, meaning the Ashkenazim accepted the ruling of the Tosfos, of the Rosh, and then the Rama. So when the Rama rules like the Tosfos and the Rosh, etc., the Rama is actually continuing an Ashkenazi tradition, minhag, of who to paskin like. But this minhag is binding. If an Ashkenazi wakes up one morning and he says, "Mom, Dad, I'm going to put schnitzel on the plata." So they say, "Son, we're Ashkenazim. We don't do that. You can't put it directly on the plata." So he goes, "Excuse me. Rabbi Yosef Karo was chief rabbi of Tzfat. He's a very big rabbi. Not good enough for you? Why, you wouldn't eat his chicken? If he served you hot schnitzel, Rabbi Yosef Karo, you wouldn't eat his schnitzel? You know, I once had a guest who did that to me. Chacham Ovadia Yosef is a big rabbi. If he invited you to his house, you would say it's not kosher?" Right? That's not a fair question. That's not the point. It's kosher for him, and my custom is different, and I have to go with my custom. I'm not questioning him. I'm saying he has to go with his custom, and I have to go with my custom. So, but here, the custom is very different. Here, it could go to the point of biblical. We have minagim in things that are d'oraita. We don't put on tefillin on Chol HaMoed. That's biblical. I have to put on tefillin every day. Why am I not putting on tefillin? So minhag, when it comes to halacha, the idea that I go with the custom of who we rule by, that's a third type of minhag, and that's powerfully binding. However, if you move into Egypt, so you then you accept the Egyptian customs. If you move into a Sephardi, if you move maybe into Italy, I don't know what goes on in Italy today, but once upon a time, Italy had a solid minhag, the Italian minhag. Once upon a time, Spain had the Spanish minhag. Once upon a time, if you moved to certain countries, they had their minhag. And then if you moved to that country, or if you moved to Morocco. So the Moroccans have a minhag. They eat rice. Okay, I don't know, Moroccans might not eat rice on Pesach. But if you moved to Tunisia, okay, you moved to Chaleb. Okay, you move to a place where the Sfaradim live there and they have a custom. So then you become Sfaradi. Gamarnu, you moved into a place that has a set custom, you have to go with their custom, for better and for worse, in both directions.
So how come it doesn't work with Israel?
Israel, we have whole communities that came here and they outnumbered the original communities. You had tens of thousands of Ashkenazim and tens of thousands of Sfaradim and tens of thousands of Yemenites. So they came as communities, so they came with their minagim. That's what Rav Moshe says. He's not so clear that Rav Yechiel Michal Tikushinsky's book on Minhag Eretz Yisrael is binding to everyone. He says it's not obvious to him at all.
You have stuff like Minhag Yerushalayim.
So he says it's not clear to him that it's binding. However, he says certain things.
Didn't you have a story about the way Chatan and Akalas walked down the aisle? And Rav Avram Shapiro said, "No, this is the Minhag."
That's because he's Yerushalmi.
No. But there's communities. I'm saying like
it's not clear that a different Rav would have said what he said.
Oh, I see.
It's not so I'm saying he said it. Fine, we respect it. it's question is it still minag Yerushalayim?
Seems very hard where to put the dot.
Right? Agreed? Right? These things are not always obvious black and white, but as a general rule, this is how we work. However, we should note that the Tosfos write, minhag is the same letters as Geinom. Sometimes people will take a minhag, they'll take something and they'll say, that's our custom. And then they can be very destructive with that. And Tosfos actually discussed it in the area of Gittin, where there are things that the rabbi said are not a kosher get. And then other people would say, but that's our custom. Well, that doesn't override the rabbinic ruling. So our rule is that a minhag is respected when we know it came from a community that had a rabbi overseeing what was done in that community. When you know that there was a rabbi present and he was overseeing and the people listened to him, there are communities where there's a rabbi, but no one listens to him. I know a community where they hired a rabbi on condition that he doesn't move into the community. That he only shows up on Shabbos, because they don't want to hear from him. So he's not running what's going on in the community. It's very nice that he's the rabbi there. They want him as a visiting rabbi. Permanently visiting.
It says that in the Gemara,
right? So the concept is, if the community has a rabbi that oversees what they're doing and he knows what he's talking about, then we say their custom is a real custom. Then we respect it and we say, don't forgo their custom. Okay, so that was a quick overview of a few concepts in Minhagim. There's much more to be discussed, like how does a Ger choose a Minhag, Chozer B'tshuva, which Minhagim can a person change? Can a person change Minhagim? When does a Taras Nedarim come in? Why is a Minhag binding like a vow? A minhag has multiple obligations, meaning some minhagim I'm obligated to from the verse Al Titosh Torat Imecha. I'm not allowed to change from what my mommy taught me, the custom of the family. You ask your mommy, why do you do that? She says, I don't know, son, but this is what Jews do, so just do it. Right? So she doesn't know the reasoning, but she's telling you this is what Jews do. That's one obligation of minhag. Then you have another obligation of minhag, which is l'olam al yeshana adam ipnei machloket. Don't do different than the custom of the place, because you're going to end up causing fights. Everyone sits down, you stand up. Everyone stands up, you sit down. You're going to annoy people, and then it'll cause arguments. So Chazal said, don't change from the custom of the place. Like Hillel said, al tereh omed, al tereh yoshev. You shouldn't stand out when everyone's sitting, you shouldn't stand. When everyone's standing, you shouldn't sit. So that's another concept in minhagim. There are a few concepts. I'm saying we didn't touch on everything. The idea that a minhag is also based in a neder, that when we have a custom to do something, it's obligational, like a vow. And certain minhagim you can actually change with hatarat nedarim. A person can convene a court and annul his vow and change his minhagim. Whereas other minhagim, like the minhag to be an Ashkenazi, you can't show up one morning and say, court, I want you to annul my vow. I know I'm Ashkenazi. I want to become Sephardi. I want to go like the Shulchan Aruch. That won't work. That's binding. You're part of a community, because it's different than the other minhagim.